Well, after following the talk about gaming and its interaction with futurist ideas, I want to anchor things a little bit more, even though a lot of what I'm saying seems very futurist and certainly relies on new technology. Astronomy, like many other sciences, has benefited hugely from the revolutions in electronics and networks, with the result that amateurs, people with, you know, self-taught with no formal training necessarily, can now do things, if they want to, at a research level that nobody in the world was doing some years ago. There are people who, you can go out to Sam's or Walmart and buy a telescope with fairly precise computer-controlled pointing and tracking. You can get off the shelf, write somebody a check. You can get a solid-state digital imaging system that's more capable than any observatory in the world had when I started my career. Image processing software has proliferated. You know, Photoshop is not just for faking pictures. And again, the proliferation of cheap computers. My laptop now works much faster than the State Supercomputer Center in Huntsville did when I first got here. Also, one of the lessons astronomers learned ahead of people in some other branches of science is that good things happen when you share data. There are enormous compilations of data, catalogs, imagery, spectra, available for access online if you know where to find them. And you can get to them because we're all gifted with very fast network connections and retrieval protocols. When the Hubble Space Telescope was launched, people recognized that there would be great scientific value to recycling its data, to retrieving somebody else's observations from the archive and doing a new analysis. But at that time, they seriously thought this would mean a room full of people copying 9-track tape reels and sticking them in FedEx boxes. Because it was really only 5 years later that it became possible to browse the archive with a web form and siphon the data right onto your desktop. Now, this isn't what amateur astronomy is necessarily all about. There's a wonderful role that I like to enjoy for staring into the night sky. But there are people who really have gone an enormous way in this direction. New digital detectors are sensitive. The best photographic film registered maybe 2% of the light falling on it. It is a crummy charge coupled device that doesn't peak above 80% efficiency. So, you know, it's like all your telescopes suddenly had a mirror 40 times as big in area. They're very stable. You can calibrate them much more repeatably and accurately than you could for photography. I'll show some examples here. Some of these were done with our observatory on campus because except for being the heavy-duty research-grade stuff because it's got to put up with generations of students who don't necessarily know what they're doing in the dark, there are lots of amateurs who have comparable stuff. Here are pictures of some star clusters taken from two buildings down on campus. And what's remarkable is these were all taken on a night when if you walked outside, you could only see 5 stars through the haze. Things that are difficult to see if you go out in the country with a telescope of the same size become easy, not only to record, but to measure. And there are people who use this not just for recording pretty pictures, but taking advantage of the fact that amateurs have a lot of telescopes at their disposal. They have, you know, they own their telescope. They can use it all the time. They don't have to fight over it like we do. You can follow exploding supernovae. This one went off about 60 million light years away. She had some students track its rise and fall. Tim Puckett over in the mountains of North Georgia got interested in supernovae, got hold of a surplus Smithsonian tracking camera originally used for satellites, put the electronic detectors on it, and has a very fruitful search program with an international and online character. He has it set up robotically to take pictures of hundreds of galaxies a night, and he arranges with colleagues on the other side of the planet to look at them right away. It's working hours there. So if there's anything new, they find it in time to report the discovery, and before anybody in North America has a chance to find it again the next night. Now, there's a long history of amateur astronomers helping track variable stars. The subclass of stars whose light is not constant is really interesting. It includes stars that pulsate, stars which erupt because material's falling on them, stars which eclipse each other as they orbit. And in some cases, there is a century's record from visual observations, people night after night comparing how bright sets of stars look. Well, you can do that digitally. Here's an example up in the corner. This was done by one of my students in the Astronomy 203 class. This is a close pair of stars, a red dwarf and a white dwarf, so close together they orbit each other in 4.8 hours. He came in on a nice winter night, tracked an entire orbit. And it was really very impressive. He was doing the measurements within 4 minutes of real time, so we had the updated plot, and we could watch the combined light of the stars dim. It was really very impressive realizing that we were sitting here on top of the physics building on campus watching the orbital motion of stars hundreds of light years away. Amateurs have ended up being able to contribute to a new but burgeoning branch of astronomy, the search for planets around other stars. 15 years ago, we were all sure that a lot of stars like the Sun must have planets, but they're so hard to see that we couldn't prove it. And the key breakthroughs there came in instrument stability and sophistication of software. Amateur teams have not been far behind. The way most planets around our stars have been found is something known as reflex Doppler, which is a highly refined version of the way that some police officers use to catch, well, some of your friends speeding. Gravity is symmetric. As a star's gravity holds a planet in orbit, the planet's gravity perturbs the star's motion. Even if you can't see the planet, if you can measure changes in wavelength accurately at the parts per million level, you can tell that the star is being perturbed back and forth through space by the planet. For one of the most obvious of these perturbations, an amateur team in Arizona has used a 16-inch telescope to detect one of the planets in this way. Again, nobody in the world could do that before 1995. And what's interesting is one of these stars with a Jupiter-like planet, people had looked at all the time because it's right next to the Dumbbell Nebula. Amateurs have also contributed to a way of finding planets and measuring them that has fewer targets but is extremely fruitful. For that subset of planets around other stars that we see pass in front of the stars, a so-called transit, that tells us how big the planet is. It can give us targets to use, for example, the Hubble Space Telescope to tell what their atmosphere is made of. If you have a planet like Jupiter cross in front of a star like the Sun, that star dims by about 1%. And with solid-state detectors, amateur astronomers are perfectly capable of measuring it. And there are whole sets of these stars where the only people watching to see if this happens are amateurs. if you have a whole bunch of stars that only have a 5% probability each of having a planet, and a professional is not going to take a lot of time on a big in-demand telescope to try it. But amateurs are just fine. You know, as a group, if they hit the whole sample, that's great. And they don't have the pressure to perform on each one. Amateurs are starting to do spectroscopy with a modest size, say 16-inch telescope. That used to be big, it's now modest. They can repeat a lot of the greatest hits of astronomy. Convince themselves that Saturn's moon Titan has an atmosphere with a lot of methane in it. Or measure redshifts of galaxies and reproduce, you know, convince themselves of Hubble's discovery of an expanding universe. Measure the motions of stars and even the distances of nearby ones. That plot over here is from data produced by Dennis DiCicco in the suburbs of Boston, looking at this star. This is one of the nearest stars to us. It moves across the sky very rapidly. The sine wave motion side to side is a reflection of the Earth's orbit. The amplitude of that motion tells you how distant the star is. A lot of amateurs are using this sort of equipment to help track potentially dangerous asteroids. They're discovered in large numbers. Frequently, they require immediate further observations to tell whether they fall in the hazardous or non-hazardous category. And just to show you what an issue that is, this was a snapshot plot at several years old of the location of known asteroids in the inner solar system. And you may feel a little less safe when I point out that you are here. A lot of these things out there, and most of them have to come close to Earth for us to find them. We want as much warning if one of these has our number on it as possible. If Bruce Willis is not available at the time, we need decades to properly deal with the problem. Some people have gone from the depths of space to our own backyard and track satellites. With video imaging techniques, where you can take thousands of frames in a few minutes and snap only those sharpest, the moments when the atmosphere was calm, you can get very impressive images of, well, especially big things like shuttles. This is just an amazing image done with a 10-inch telescope of the International Space Station. In fact, even with a telescope that size, even just sort of trying to follow it and fishing it into the field of view for a second or two, you can see the major solar panels and modules. Word has it that the work of a guy who started at a museum in Boston doing this attracted enough attention that he got a visit from some of the people in blue suits who have had their senses of humor surgically removed, who gave him a set of orbital elements for a satellite, wanted to know if he could find it and track it and what he could see on it. And right there in front of, you know, it was a non-published satellite. And right there in front of them, he acquired it and got some images, and apparently they were not amused because they were figuring that what somebody on a shoestring at a science museum in Boston could do, pretty much any government on the planet could do. It's the 21st century. We're stuck with it. There are people who have done amazing things pushing the capabilities of modest telescopes. Multi-night exposures, very delicate image processing. Now, this is a galaxy which has been known for 150 years. But only recently was this curlicue of faint starlight around it discovered. It's dimmer compared to the galaxy than it looks here. It's pushed up just so you can see it. This was discovered on images by amateur astronomer Jay Gavani, representing the history of tidal destruction of a small dwarf galaxy. And there are actually professional astronomers now working with groups of amateurs to extend this, because per square inch of telescope time, using these small telescopes for long exposures is the most efficient way to find these features. People in their backyards are doing things that nobody in the world could do 20 or 25 years ago, yielding images of the moon and planets, pushing right down to the theoretical limits of optics with cheap technology, with hacked webcams. You put one on your telescope, put relay lenses to magnify the image, take a long video sequence, and have your software go through, line them up automatically by cross-correlation, use the Fourier transform of each image to tell you which ones are sharpest, and throw away all but the 1% where the atmosphere was most cooperative. And in fact, the state-of-the-art software for doing this process is a piece of shareware put together by an international consortium of amateurs who are also very good Windows programmers. So they're pushing down here the little collapsed lava tube down the middle of that valley on the moon was something that was originally discovered from lunar orbiter photographs. Because in the days of photography, when you had to expose longer, you'd never catch the atmosphere that steady. This sort of technique was used by Australian amateur Anthony Wesley, whose name on a lot of discussion boards is Bird, to find that a comet had hit Jupiter last summer. And they pushed Hubble out of its recommissioning to observe this event, because it had only ever been seen to happen once before with certainty, and maybe once in the late 1700s based on observing logs. Another area where there's a new species of armchair participant in astronomy now. What I've heard described as open source image processing. There are huge troves, terabytes now, of available data looking out at the universe from ground-based telescopes, sky surveys, Hubble. Planetary data. Some of the people driving the Mars rovers have asked for help from some of these amateur online communities. They said, okay, you guys have been pretty good so far. We don't want the other rover to get stuck in a sand drift, but we'd like to get from this crater to here. Based on all of the events, you know, if I tell you what's been our best driving territory so far, and you grab these overhead images, can you do anything to help tell what the best route for us might be? And this was really interesting to watch. People would try filtering, Fourier transforms, and you could watch the development of the techniques go around the world as the Earth rotated and people got into their best working hours. It was very cool when the Phoenix lander landed to look for ice at the North Martian pole. At the initial press conference, one of the reporters said, okay, when are we going to see the pretty color panoramas all stitched together of the Martian polar surface? And the science team members told them, we're really busy here trying to run a lander. We're just putting this stuff all up as raw JPEGs on the website. Go to the people at unmannedspaceflight.com, and they're going to do just as good a job as we would, and they're going to have it way sooner, because they apparently never sleep. One of the things that's made this possible is I didn't adequately realize when I was a graduate student what a brilliant thing the astronomical community had done here, until many years later when I saw that people in geophysics and medical imaging and so forth are still banging their heads on data formats. the world astronomical community got together, fought, argued, banged heads together, and agreed in 1978 on one common extensible data storage format. And, you know, the people who made this happen, someday there are going to be shrines to their memory. Because we can exchange data worldwide. And everybody's software can read and write this format. So it means that, for example, as soon as some people got together and wrote a Photoshop plugin to read the FITS format, everybody was off and running. This is the standard for archiving data from all NASA astronomy missions, all major ground-based observatories. It can be read and written by standard amateur CCD software. Crack this and you have untold data riches at your fingertips. So people can sit down at their desk and remix Hubble data or put together color products from Hubble data that have never been publicly released. Or here is a nice example. Ted Strike, who is an amateur image processor and a philosophy professor in his day job, realized that one of the moons of Neptune discovered by Voyager 2 had passed in front of the planet and Voyager 2 should have seen its shadow. I guess so that would be Groundhog Day on Neptune. But nobody had ever made the connection. They'd been looking for the data and other things. So it was just last year, 20 years after the fact, that he found, yes, indeed, if you looked through the Voyager data very carefully, you could find its shadow and, in fact, refine its orbit. And at this point, the single biggest harvest of comets ever found by any instrument has been found in data from an instrument that was staring at the sun, looking at its corona, called SOHO. SOHO has found 1,674 comets to this point, most of them little small things that are paying no attention and blundered into the sun and are never seen again. And almost all of these were found by people not associated with the mission team, amateurs. One of them, scripting skills seems to be important. There was one guy who found a whole bunch of these. He lived in Europe. I think it was in Germany. He just set up a script so that every morning his computer loaded the SOHO data, ran them as a movie. He looked at them over his morning coffee. And the important thing was that he figured he was making great hay because he finished this before all of the competition in North America woke up every day. Now this has been taken over by the twin stereo spacecraft, one of which is ahead of the Earth in its orbit, one of which is behind, so I actually get a stereo view, meaning you can now look for comets in front of the sun in 3D. Or you can discover thousands of quasars by cross-correlating sky images and catalogs. And for extra credit, you can publish your results before some of the professional observing teams manage it. Now, one of the most powerful examples of this has been described as the greatest science hit of the Web 2.0 era. As anybody who reads Douglas Campbell knows, the universe is an unsettlingly big place. It's full of things, and they turn up in huge numbers. As telescopes reach deeper, we have larger, more complete data sets. A particularly good example was the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, which has covered slightly more than a quarter of the sky with five filters from near ultraviolet to near infrared with a telescope scanning the sky from New Mexico. A million of these have spectra, so we have redshifts, distances. And, you know, most of this data had never actually been looked at by a human being. There were automated catalogs and various model parameters for these. But astronomers started to realize a few years ago there were important pieces of science that really would require somebody looking at all this stuff. And the real genius of the project began, I guess as so many things do, when a couple of astronomers walked into a bar. Well, a pub. So here we see the ancestral pub of the Galaxy Zoo project. Actually began with a sort of disgusted conversation over a pint between Chris Lintott and Kevin Shavinsky, who at the time was finishing his doctoral work. And he had had to stare at 50,000 galaxy images, and he thought his eyes were going to ooze out of his skull at this point. But as they talked, they realized there were some key science questions that could be resolved if they could have all of the million brightest galaxies in the Sloan survey looked at by volunteers who could be trained very quickly to distinguish galaxies with clockwise from counterclockwise arms, galaxies that were possibly merging, elliptical galaxies from spirals. So they literally, on the back of a napkin, sketched out a computing structure that would allow people to do this and set it up. And except for computer services, the original budget of the project was something like £100. They set it up, went live. It happened to be a slow day on the BBC. So Project Needs Public's Online Help for Galaxies was one of the top five emailed stories from the BBC website that day. So many people tried to sign up within a couple of hours that their original server was physically damaged. It's trying to make the disk do things. One of the lessons was, be ready for that. They said the project would have gone down in flames if they hadn't had people at Johns Hopkins who were able to assemble a couple of new servers before all of the people who were interested in the project got disgusted and went away and never came back. The project caught on. This is partly a result of a media bump. It was partly because the task was simple enough that they were able to come up with a very clean and a lot of people think addictive interface. And as a result, they thought that, you know, they would get several thousand people, and as a result, that project would be done in 3 or 4 years. By now, there are over 250,000 zooites, they call themselves, who've been classifying galaxies. All of the original sample galaxies have been classified by 60 people, and it turns out to be really interesting. You not only have the mean, but the distribution of classifications. They have been able to open up more detailed classifications. We're preparing to move into Hubble Zoo. So the team has expanded. I joined the science team after a few months. Well, this is after I showed up in the discussion forum looking at some science questions. I had the distinction of being the first person to be banned while people figured out who I was and what I was doing there. I only found that out later. I never knew I was unbanned before I found out. And in fact, there are two people who each say the other one was the one who banned me. So the entire science team has never been together in one place. In fact, I think it's still true that there's no one on the science team who has met everyone else on the science team. So we're an actual 21st century geographically distributed project. So at a partial team meeting in London, here's zookeeper Chris and the astronomers of the round table. So this was the original Galaxy Zoo interface. And after doing a quick tutorial, you'd sign on, be presented with a galaxy, and your task was to see which one of these categories it fell in. Clockwise or counterclockwise, I guess in England they call it anticlockwise. Or edge-on spiral, elliptical, merging galaxy with some tidal damage and distortion, or a star or something that fell outside the category. Part of the addictive nature was never knowing what that next galaxy would be. Most of them were very dim without much detail, but then occasionally you'd get some magnificent spiral filling the whole field of view with blue knots of star formation and so forth. So the results of this project dealt wonderfully with some of the original science goals. Also, a lot of other stuff has happened. The project has taken on a life of its own. It has a very dynamic and activist set of users, many of whom communicate on a project forum. The forum was originally created as an afterthought. So many people joined the project that the scientists and IT support people couldn't keep up with the emails. So they thought, well, we'll set up a forum. Maybe they can answer each other's questions. Turns out a lot of extra value science takes place on the forum. And these are really interested people. This was at right before a team meeting in London. We had this large meetup. This is a full 0.014% of the users participating in the project, many of whom we would recognize only by their names on the forum. You know, for example, this is Fluffy Porcupine and Stellar 190. This is Stellar's mom, who had to drive her around because Stellar was only 14 at the time. This is Budgie Eye. Here's Quark Spin. So we've discovered that there are exceptions to general rules about galaxies. Spiral galaxies generally have lots of young stars. They're blue. Elliptical galaxies have only stars, old stars. They're red, except when they're not. The Galaxy Zoo project was right in the forefront of documenting that there are galaxies that break this rule. And where they occur has important clues to how galaxies work. The project discovered that in people's classifications of galaxies, there was a statistically significant bias to galaxies whose spiral arms are S-curved instead of the opposite. And they were able to put in some tests, serving people up images that were rotated, mirror imaged, black and white versus color, and it turns out it's people's brains that are biased, not the galaxies. There's some interesting neuropsychological work to be done there. Then there were things that grew out of participants, things or patterns that the volunteers, the zooites, noticed. A category of tiny galaxies with odd spectra that have come to be known as the peas or the green peas. This, the scientists on the project weren't really interested in until some of the participants were able to make a case that they were a distinct kind of galaxy, taught themselves SQL, went out, queried the databases, pulled together the properties. I got started in the project by trying to study dust in galaxies and improving the sample of galaxy pairs suitable for that. There have been participant discoveries. The signature cool thing from Galaxy Zoo has been Honey's Vorwerk, which I'll talk about in a minute. My original interest was noticing that a lot of the galaxies people were posting pictures of on the discussion forum for as possible colliding or merging galaxies looked more like pairs of unrelated galaxies along the line of sight. This is something I had been using for a long time to try to study dust in galaxies, where you have a nice background source. But we'd run out of nearby galaxies to try it on. Suddenly, people were going through this huge new sky survey, and out of a million galaxies, they were, you know, they could help me find the ones that I could do this for. And from 20 good pairs for this, we've gone to 2,000. These were some of the ones that people had posted before I even asked and was taken into the team as sort of an official side project of the zoo. So we've been following this up, particularly with this telescope in Arizona. And this is part of, these are some of our images, where you can nicely see in some cases the dust in one galaxy backlit by another. So we can analyze that to tell how much dust is where in ways that are much more difficult to do with other techniques. This has turned into Anna Manning's thesis work here at Alabama. We just saw that. We've got so many that we can break them up into pieces. X galaxies, where we see the two crossing each other at an angle, or Q type pairs, where one cuts straight out from the back. These turn out to be especially nice for analysis. Deep overlaps, where one galaxy shines almost straight behind another one. We've just submitted a proposal to use the Hubble and Spitzer space telescopes to look at some of these. And here's an example of the sort of mapping that we can do of the dust in a galaxy. And dust is important because it's a product of star formation and it is a participant in star formation. It's the cheapest way we can measure the dense, cold interstellar material that participates in the birth of stars. We've had people on the forum who've become really interested in analyzing spectra. One of them pointed out this bizarre star, which had been looked at by a specialist years ago, but he never published it, so I think we've shaken loose his analysis. I had never seen a spectrum like this. It turns out to be this is a rare kind of star, a DZ dwarf, a white dwarf star, star at the end of its life, which has had heavy elements dumped onto it from a companion star or something else. Normally you don't see these because the white dwarf is small. Its gravity is very intense, so those atoms settle to the bottom. This is maybe the most extreme with the most heavy elements. And one of the leading models for how you get this is this star has just devoured or destroyed the last solid remnants of what was once a planetary system. And we could tell it must be very nearby because you could watch it move. If you line up these pictures, photograph from 57, the Sloan data from 2001, what I did the start of this year, you can see that this star and its companion move significantly. So we know already they have to be close to us in the sky. So I've gotten some additional data looking for their orbital motion. See if I can define how these two stars are related to each other. Now the story of Honey's Forverb, which has been very interesting as an example of science coming out of a project like this, as well as having a lot of new scientific impact. Only a couple of weeks after the forum opened, after the project went on, a participant known as Honey just asked, "What's the blue stuff below? Anyone?" and posted this picture. A spiral galaxy with a shapeless deep blue blob right below it. Something like two dozen people had already seen this galaxy and not remarked on anything. Honey's presence on the project didn't come from her being really interested in astronomy to begin with. She's an elementary school teacher in the southern part of the Netherlands and also plays a fairly mean guitar. She was a Queen fan, followed Brian May's blog, and since Brian May has actually finished his doctorate in astrophysics after that whole interruption for 20 years to be a rock star thing, he mentioned the Galaxy Zoo project. She got into it and got hooked. So the astronomers on the project collected what data they had, and was interesting and unusual, couldn't pin down what it was. I got some more data using a remotely operated telescope in Arizona, and we could tell that it had a huge amount of light in one small piece of the spectrum and not much elsewhere. That could be a cloud of gas associated with this galaxy, could be something in the deep background in the early universe. We needed to get a spectrum. So, employing the time-honored technique of astronomers for decades, we looked at the observatory schedules around the world to see where some of our buddies might happen to be working with appropriate instruments. Right after I first met Chris Lintott at a meeting in Texas, a couple of colleagues got these observations with a telescope in the Canary Islands. Now, remember what I said about the internationally agreed standard for data interchange? Well, they sent us the data right afterward. What did they send us? a screen snap JPEG with no documentation, no digital data. But after staring at it for a few minutes and figuring out what part of the spectrum it was clear this was not a normal region of gas lit up by young stars. It was something very different because certain of these spectral lines tell you that this gas is exposed to very hard ultraviolet and soft X-ray radiation. Doubly ionized helium, quadruply ionized neon. You see these only in gas that's lit up by things like quasars. This montage shows the final reduced version when we really got the data files for the spectrum of Honey's Forver. But it started to be called Honey's Forver. It started as a joke because it was badly translated Dutch. Forwerp is Dutch for object. But it stuck now. We got into the journal paper. Once I tried to track where various press releases had done, so I thought I'd look maybe for my name and the word Forwerp. No. Kiel in Dutch, kale means throat. Kale Forwerp is the Dutch word for throat obstruction. So if you Google that combination, you get all these hits from Amsterdam about emergency medicine. Seemed like a good idea at the time. The science was so compelling here, even on the basis of our original reports that we put in the Galaxy Zoo project blog, that, for example, a team of Dutch and British radio astronomers looked at it. We've looked at it with several satellites. We've got time on more, particularly anticipated are three sets of Hubble observations that should be coming up in the next couple of months. So here's the best image we have of it so far, which is really good. It's about the best ground-based image I've ever got. We got it with the Wind Telescope in Arizona. So this green thing is Honey's Forwerp. It's green because of the very strong peak from doubly ionized oxygen. It's a cloud of gas. It's very spread out in space. It's as large as the galaxy. It's larger than the Milky Way. And the properties of this gas tells you that this sees an intense source of high-energy radiation. This gas sees a quasar, which we don't. So just to avoid confusion, here's a distinguishing chart. This is Honey's Forwerp. This is Honey herself. They're very different. Honey is at a distance of about 6 times 10 to the minus 10 light years. The Forwerp is about 700 million light years away. The galaxy up at the top was cataloged a long time ago, but nothing unusual was noted. So here we have this highly ionized gas cloud and a massively inadequate galaxy nucleus. It's been looked at with radio telescopes that at least show where the gas comes from. In this superposition, the orange shows where cold clouds of hydrogen gas are. And there's one that wraps halfway around the galaxy. That sort of smells like some other galaxy came close, the big galaxy's gravity pulled it apart. And where there's intense radiation hitting it, we see Honey's Forwerp. This is such a big deal that there was a press release associated with the discovery paper. For a 7-minute period, it was the top story on CNN.com. And you'll notice that I did hit the screen snap during this period. This was good for some thousands of new people to try out Galaxy Zoo and get hooked. We've carried on some of the science follow-up, looking for more of these things. It turns out using the remotely operated telescope of the SARah Consortium, I can conduct this dead quasar survey from my den, sometimes assisted by cats, because at 2 in the morning, apparently, my open logbook is the most interesting place in the house. People in the zoo have also helped finding smaller but related objects. clouds of gas, not completely outside galaxies, but on their outskirts, lit up by energetic nuclei, or low-grade quasars, whether we see them or not. The reason is, in the particular color renditions given by the Sloan survey, they show up as a very pure, intense blue. In fact, one participant has called it Forbert blue. And once I noticed this, I was discussing it on the forum, and one of the longtime active zoo participants, who also runs an IT firm, has set up the structure for allowing people to hunt through large samples. So we took 16,000 galaxies whose spectra made them candidates for this, wanted 10 people to check, okay, has it got a blue cloud? Definitely not, or maybe. So we got more than 10 views each. At least 3 people within 1 month looked at every one of the 16,000 galaxies. So we have follow-up work scheduled on a couple of telescopes to do this. In fact, I've just realized that the project spun off from the Galaxy Zoo Forum, things that the project didn't even see coming, have been such a scientific bonanza that all of my external research funding right now is follow-up projects spun off from Galaxy Zoo. It's not just me. NASA is also underwriting, well, in fact, has underwritten reworking of the computing structure here to easily support other kinds of citizen science projects. We just found out that a grant application was approved through Pamela Gay at Southern Illinois to experiment with a Facebook app to let people classify galaxies and share it with their friends. The Galaxy Zoo universe has expanded into the Zooniverse, which includes projects to examine computer models of galaxies, to track solar eruptions from the STEREO spacecraft. In a couple of months, Moon Zoo should go live, where people can identify lunar craters, which ones have boulders or not. That turns out to tell you how deep the lunar regolith, the pulverized soil, is down to bedrock. This could yield interesting results in what parts of the moon have what geology and history, as well as what ones might be suitable for exploitation and habitation in the era of a return to the moon. Other things coming up: application of Galaxy Zoo to very deep Hubble Space Telescope observations. So then we will be tracing the history of galaxies with a group of people doing the same kind of mass analysis from the local universe to the very distant universe. And it's not obvious from what we know now how to properly correct for the changes in how galaxies look with various wavelengths with redshift. We realized with this many people working this hard, we can actually try them all and compare them. There's a proposal underway to use the Galaxy Zoo approach on new sky surveys. It may not work for the largest scale sky survey coming up. It just generates too much data. But it gives you a massive training set. So I think what we'll be seeing there is a synergy between human classification and machine classification. And there are even possibilities of going beyond astronomy. There are people interested in Papyrus Zoo, having people sort the characters on shattered, fragmentary ancient papyri. Because once that's done, computers can then experiment with their reconstruction. We may be at one of those points now in astronomy when what we can learn is running behind what the hardware and even the software will allow, because the wetware needs to catch up And this is as true for professionals as amateurs. So I want to leave off. It is a big universe out there, but all together we can grok it more fully. I'll put in here the obligatory plug for the Galaxy Z URL. And by way of thanking the Galaxy Zoo volunteers, I won't scroll by all their names, so I'll just show you a small sample here, standing in for the rest. And I'll leave off with a list of places that you can start if you think this is the sort of thing you might be interested in doing. Thank you.
Thank you.